Coming to the end of the pause moment, which we now invite you to bring your snack, bring your coffee, and find a seat. Whether you're joining us for the first time or already a part of our family, I'm excited that you're joining us as we reimagine what our faith could look like if we realize that it's a party rather than a wake that we're reimagining. My name is Glenn. I'm part of the teaching team. And as you heard earlier, we are a Jesus-centered community creating gracious space through acts of generous love. Which means as we go through our series, as we go through our sermons, often we'll be pulling on one of these tenets to unpack the passage. If this is your first time with me, I want to let you know what to expect. We will sit in the text by reading the whole passage. Then we'll walk through the text where I'll offer some notes on the critical movements in the scripture, how the Gospel of Luke plays with some of the concepts. Then we'll riff from the text, which is the part where we wrestle with the message of the text simply because a 2,000-year-old document is not always readily accessible for us. We have to wrestle of what do these implications mean, how do we step into it, and how do we move from these stories we hear. So before we read Luke 15, 11 to 32, I need to set the stage a little bit. Because our assumptions about people or our stereotypes create the world that we live into, and it creates the narratives or backstories for the other people that we meet. Typically, when we say this person is a liberal or a conservative, if we say this person is religious or spiritual, if we name a kind of Christianity, we usually have a backstory filled with assumptions shaping who is this person. These assumptions can miss the multi-story, delayered effect of what it is to be human, which adds the richness to encountering somebody else. This became very real for me when my lovely wife, knowing that my birthday falls in the fall next to American Thanksgiving. Because of that, I never got a birthday party because I had family. And who wants to have a party when you can have pumpkin pie with your cousins? And that's what we did. And she heard that, so she's like, my 30th birthday's coming, it's a big milestone. She's like, I'm gonna throw him a party. But the people we had known in the town is the small church I typically worked with. I don't know if you've had any experience with small holiness movements, is what they're called, but they tend to be a little bit prohibitive in nature. We really like what you're not allowed to do. I was their token rebel. So the senior pastor, the associate pastor, the youth pastor, the worship leader, the elder board, would all come to my house and have scotch beer, sit in my study, and we discuss life, religion, future, what we're wrestling with. And Brittany saw each of these people sharing a drink, talking about God and all these beautiful things. She goes, well, what would be so much better than one person? What if I invited all of them to surprise Glenn for his birthday party? So I come into the house, and Brittany is a great hostess. She knew every single one of these people usually shared a beer with me. So she's like, I'm having 30 of them over. I probably should get more beer. And there's a cooler in the center of the room with pumpkin beer because it's fall and that is glorious. And every single person up against the back of the wall like this. Because what she didn't know, what she couldn't know, is that the cardinal rule of Pentecostal traditions is don't do things in front of other people. And two people went up and grabbed me, leaned in and went, psst, Glenn, there's beer and the pastor's over there. And I was like, yes, I guess I can't out him and say, well, he comes over all the time. But, sorry. So you had everyone back against the wall like it was a junior high dance. They're unsure of how do you cross the divide and say, do you want to come to the dance floor with me? All watching the other person like, is anyone else dancing? Because she didn't know the multi-story. She knew they all knew me, and by proximity of my friendship, of course they're going to all get along. Because they all did the same thing at my house until there's more people. The same thing happens with our expectations of the biblical text. At times, our assumptions about the characters influence our experience, the Gospel of Luke. This can have us watching the narrative unfold in Luke like 1940s cowboy movies. Black hat is bad, white hat is good. Bad guys do bad things, good guys do good things. Or we might see it as Pharisees versus Jesus. We have these shallow, single-dimension, single-storied characterizations, which may hold a thread of truth. but it fails the complexity of the people that are represented. So let's add some depth to the characters that are going to be around the passage we're reading so that we can give them a richer backstory and fully step into their narrative. The characters each represent a different way of anticipating the kingdom of God. Jesus was defining a new way that could not use coercion, that wasn't going to fight Rome, but said, everyone gather around my table. All of you who disagree, who blame each other, who are at odds and fighting, sit at my table. While the sinners and tax collectors are those who would say the kingdom will never come. Maybe you've lost hope the kingdom can be now. So we'll get what we can. The tax collectors gave money to Rome, but also used their position to rob other people. Sinners would just be those who say, yes, we're Jewish in name, but this cultic practice really does nothing for us, so we're just going to remove ourselves because this is all you have. The scribes and Pharisees are the ones we usually misunderstand. Because coming into Luke, the scribes and Pharisees came as a way for the people to talk about what does it look like for us to anticipate the kingdom of God. They weren't legalists. They weren't rigid zealots for rules. They were covenant loyalists. They said, because our covenant, therefore we, because God showed up, therefore we must do. And they were anticipating the time in which God would return and said, what kind of people would be the ones anticipating God's return? We will become like those people. So all of them were fighting over how they saw the story ending. Is it oblivion and this is all we have? Is there a hope only for the few righteous? Or what Jesus said, is there hope in the community gathered? So there's no conversion in these scenes. They're all Jews. They come from a Jewish faith. There's only table and tension as they disagree on how we live out the faith. And I want you to know that the Pharisee, the one that is zealous for the text, is a gift. Because the gift of the Pharisee is the reason why you have Luke and Acts, because Luke is understood to be someone trained by Paul. And you have 1 and 2 Corinthians, 1 and 2 Thessalonians, 1 and 2 Timothy, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Philemon, and Titus. All thanks to the nuanced giftings of the Pharisee. These aren't our black hat villains. They're the ones who are asking good questions. So let us sit in the text now, and I'm going to read through. I'll start with verses 1 and 2 and 15. All the tax collectors were coming close to listen to Jesus. The Pharisees and legal experts were grumbling. This fellow welcomes sinners, they said. He even eats with them. Jesus told a couple of parables, then went on and said, once there was a man who had two sons. The younger son said to the father, Father, give me my share in the property. So he divided up his livelihood between them. Not many days later, the young son turned his share into cash and set off for a country far away, where he spent his share in having a riotous good time. When he had spent it all, a severe famine came on that country. He found himself destitute. He went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into the fields to feed the pigs. He longed to satisfy his hunger with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one would give him anything. He came to his senses. Just think, he said to himself, there are all my father's hired hands with plenty to eat, and here I am starving to death. I shall get up and go to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against before you. I don't deserve to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired hands. He got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and his heart was stirred with love and compassion. He ran to him, hugged him tight, and kissed him. Father, the son began, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I don't deserve to be called your son any longer. But the father said to the servants, hurry, bring the best clothes and put them on him. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet. Bring the calf that we've fattened up. Kill it. Let's eat and have a party. This son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now he's found. They began to celebrate. The older son was out in the fields when he came home and got near to the house. He heard music and dancing carry out. He called one of the servants and asked, what's going on? Your brother's come home, he said. And your father has thrown a great party. He's killed the fattened calf because he got him back safe and well. The older son flew into a rage and wouldn't go in. His father came out and pleaded with them. Look here, he said to his father. I've been slaving for you all these years. I've never disobeyed a single commandment of yours. And you've never given me so much as a young goat so I could have a party with my friends. But when this son of yours comes home, once he's finished devouring your livelihood with whores, you kill the fattened calf for him? He replies, my son, you've always been with me. Everything I have belongs to you. But we had to celebrate and be happy. This brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and now he's found. And we'll sit for three breaths to let the story sink in. So if we're going to walk through this passage, because now we're going to be walking through the text. Verses 11 to 15 are the descent. And then in the descent into madness, we have verses 12 and 13a where the son says to the father, give me my share. And it makes special note that the father divided up the inheritance between both his sons. Now before the gold standard and industrialization, before we had concept that wealth equaled money, what you have in your wallet is representation of wealth. Wealth represented land and physical goods. So in order for you to take your inheritance, you had to take a part of your family estate and then sell it in the town that you lived in. Which means that the not many days implies that the youngest son was in a rush to get as much money as he can just to go party. The young son was in a rush, so he went through the entire town, shaming his whole family, showing everyone he cared less about the family's ability to have a future than he did about his ability to forget where he was. And a wealthy family in ancient times was typically a social patron. It would be someone you knew in the community that you looked to for help, that typically was seen as a shining example of God's blessing. They did things right, especially having two sons. You're actually fairly elevated there. But because the son's demand to split up the inheritance, rather than the father's need, because it did happen then, basically if you're getting to an age you couldn't manage the estate, you could divest your property early and give your inheritance to the kids. But that came with a social expectation. Dividing the inheritance early obligated those receiving the inheritance to plan for their father's future. Because remember, this is a time before 401ks, before retirement, before socialized medicine, before social insurance numbers. The only way you survived in old age is if you had children and children looked after you. So for him, his son just said, give me your security because I want it. And then rather than staying, he leaves as soon as he can. So this small town sees a whole family fall apart. One son saying, I don't care if you live or die. It's more than I just want you to die. I don't care what happens to you. I need to go. Then 13b, when I say A or B, just in case no one's done text criticism, that reverts to which half of the sentence you're dealing with. B is the second one. You never get a C. So 13b to 15, you have the son leaving Israel, blowing everything on his riotous good time. Think spring break of a trust fund baby who is richer than anyone you know. He's just going for it. And the text actually emphasizes how frivolous, how wasteful, which for a culture that says we must save in order to protect, is the ultimate offense to everyone. So 13b, it says, there, he completely blew his money, was the way the verb reads, it blew his entire existence of life. And then at the beginning of the next sentence, just in case you missed it, it said, after having blew all his money, after having completely destroyed his family inheritance, his estate, everything his family has sacrificed for, he has come to a point of spending every last penny. And it uses a verb there that riotous good time is a phrase for it. But just if you can take the next level of hedonism, debauchery, recklessness, abandon in all things except for this very moment, that's kind of what the verb holds. He wasn't just going to have a good weekend. He was going to see if he couldn't wake up tomorrow. And he said that's the way he spent everything. But then in 16 to 19, the tempo changes and there's an epiphany in the field. Because he not only left Israel, but then he attached himself to a Roman, because the verb there for a citizen is linked towards Rome. So he leaves Israel, then attaches himself to the enemy of Israel, then gets sent out into the field. And in case you didn't know it, the chief sacrifice and sacred animal for Zeus, not the Israel god, is the pig. So he goes to a Roman house, gets sent to the field to feed the swine, showing that you've fallen just about as low as you could for a Jewish man. You've lost your family estate with Gentile whores. It's bad enough if you're sleeping around in your own hometown with your own people, but now you're going to the unclean, unwashed people you never want your children with. And he's living amongst the sacrifices for other gods. And it's there that it says he comes to himself. He said, how many of my father's servants have more than enough to eat? And he gets this realization, I don't deserve to be called your son. Make me a hired worker. Now the idea of going there, it says, when I don't deserve, axios also means I'm not worthy, I haven't earned. It's used about five other times in Luke where the Roman comes through and you have the household of the Jewish leaders for the synagogue come up and say, Jesus, do you not know this man is axios? This man is worthy for you to do something for him. He's earned his spot. He showed his good faith. It has an idea of merit, of earned place because you've done the right things in the community. He said, I've lost all of it. But he can't dream of full inclusion. So what he says is, what if, and this is a long shot for me, what if I can go home and I'm a servant here? What if I attach myself to my father's household and I'm a servant there? I have no hopes of a son. I have no hopes of inclusion. I just kind of have hope that maybe you'll allow me at the most minimum place of belonging, without right, without position, without any security, save for the fact that you'll be benevolent towards me. So the younger son hoped to return without the title, honor, and authority, to become his father's house, a more protected version of what he was in the Gentile land. He didn't have hope for restoration. He had hope that maybe you'd feed him. And so verses 20 to 24 goes to the third section, that's the last we hear of the younger son, which is the return. The return is driven by the question of worth and position. Basically, it's driven by the question of what is your place in this community no matter what you've done. And it says in verse 20, while a long way off, and it uses the same thing of long way as it did of the town that's a long way off. So it's saying you're gone, you could just be in that other village. A long way off, the father saw him. And then it has this verb that means that your stomach moved. You're moved, but it's an emotional moving that's deep inside of you. It's a gut reaction that you see something that breaks your heart. So the father sees that and runs. In case you're unaware, because we like to jog now because we're a more hefty people than you were in the first century. No one ran back then if you're of a certain age. Because to rush meant you were not in power. To rush meant people didn't wait for you. My position, my honor, my esteem, my notoriety meant you wait for me if I'm a person of note. In front of everyone, the father runs because he was filled with compassion. And in verse 21, the son tries to repent and the father tries to party. And this is kind of fun because most of us would be okay. The Pharisees would be okay if Jesus sitting with the tax collectors and sinners was demanding their repentance in that moment and actively reforming them. Because if you dislike the people I dislike, we're good. If you think the ugly is the same ugly that I see, we're good. When you sit down with the people I think are corrupt and you say, let's just share a meal, I question your loyalties. And what happens here is in the middle of repenting, because it has him getting cut off, the son says, Father, I've sinned before heaven and before you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. And as though the compassion couldn't allow him to finish this phrase that he knew was coming, the father immediately turns and starts yelling at people. But just so you know, it jumps, but he was running away. No one ran with him. So this time of pleading is this time walking with his son through town back to the estate. And the son's like, no, you don't understand. I've done things wrong. And the father fell on him, hugged him, kissed him, and gave him a place of social recognition and value. Verse 22, while he's still trying to say, you don't know what I've done wrong, He turns and restores his position fully. Now, when it says, go get the best robe, when we hear robe, we don't think of much. The term there is stole, and the reason why that's important is because that was the fancy stuff the scribes wore. It was a way to give yourself distinction amongst the rabble around you. So with the scribes and Pharisees standing outside, judging what Jesus is doing, Jesus says the younger son comes back and the father yells, get the best version of what these people are wearing in front of me now for him. A signet ring was a sign of power and position. So when he said, get the ring, he said, restore the full position of the son who just burnt my life savings. The shoes were not something that you needed. A lot of people went barefoot, which shows that the father was not just concerned with necessities. When we see people we disagree with or restore, sometimes we go to the bare minimum. If I don't let you starve, we're doing so good. If I don't insult you to your face, I'm awesome. But the father kind of went that next step and wasn't just the necessities, but the luxuries of sandals not to hurt your feet. And then in 20 to 24, it's the first time we actually get to sit with the father. And they're coming back, and he's calling out. And the first time the father speaks in 22 to verse 24, just to let you know, that's one sentence. And as we've seen, the father responds at insane speeds. We need to celebrate. It's marked throughout the sentence of bring out and hurry up. So he says, hurry, bring the status and give him his position. Run, get the fattened calf we've saved for a special occasion. Prepare the party now. Suddenly, like a fast-forward movie, the party is just happening with the last phrase because the verbs are almost stacking on top of his mouth in verse 23. He says, go get the fattened calf, sacrifice it, eat it, celebrate, be happy, we're going to party. Almost as though he cannot quite have enough speed to get there. It needs to happen now. Why did I have to wait 3.5 minutes? Now. It's kind of like waiting for your book from Amazon. You can just download it on Kindle. And what is the urgency? What cannot be wait? He was dead, but he's now alive. He was lost, but he's now found. Using the phrasing from the last two parables that Kevin talked about last week. And in 24, it ends with the father's sentence having a declaration, they began to celebrate. The party was immediate. For any of you who have not planned a party for an entire village, for an entire town, it usually takes you longer than one sentence. This was rushed to illustrate a point. It was serious. Because then we get to shift our focus from the younger son coming back in the celebration to the older son out in the field, saying the right things, doing the right things, being with the right people. And we enter into the eldest son's descent. Because the eldest son is out in the field taking care of his father's estate, being about his father's business. Like the younger, when he had the epiphany in the field, in this parable, when you're in the field, you have a breakthrough moment. So as he's going forward, it says that this, I just like the word, because for music, it's symphone, and that just sounds fancy. So the symphony is carrying out over the field, and he can hear it, and there's no party planned. Why would he expect one? So it just says he turns to one of the servants, because this is all his anyways, says, hey, what's this? And the servant, again, they have the people responding, not casting judgment, but rushing to tell, because it's just like verb, object, says, your brother's home, your father killed the fattened calf because he got him back safe and well. Now, just to let you know, safe and well is not moral and right. They could have used a verb for clean. They could have used a verb for the younger son repented. They could have said something about his change, but all it demarked was, the father celebrates, he's alive. He's dirty, he's wrecked, and he celebrates him because he's here. Because in the denouncing of the family, they thought he'd be gone forever. So he says, he's here. Everything else can be forgiven. Everything else can be dealt with because the only thing I can't deal with is your absence. Which has him fly into a rage. And he wouldn't go in. The term for the rage there is the same term you see in all of Paul's letters about the wrath of God descending on a people. It's this passionate, emotive, destroying thing. He says he hears this, flies into a rage, and refuses to go in. And that shows the same structure as the father's response to the son. Both of them see from a distance, have a, a passive verb hit them to where the father sees from a distance, he's moved with compassion and runs for them. The older son hears from a distance, hears about his brother, gets filled with rage because how dare you? Do you know who this is? The father was filled with compassion. The older brother was filled with contempt. Why so angry, though? Because we've all lost family. We've all had people come back. There's few times I've seen someone come back into family that the whole family says, "We hate you, go." So why so angry at the return of his brother? The younger son consumed his own inheritance, all of it. This party of his return comes directly out of the elder brother's estate. It was a very expensive thing to sacrifice a fattened calf. So when he's coming back, he hears the music, he gets the report, and then he says, "You blew your money and now you're taking mine." Which has the older brother calling out the injustice of it. In 25 to 30, now the eldest son publicly shames his father because the father has a town-wide party because 1,000 pounds of meat is too much for one household. The whole town is there. They see him, they know him, they're celebrating. He's at the table of honor and he says, "Where's my oldest son? He won't come in." He has to leave the place of honor to go back out into the field to chase his other son. And it uses parakaleo, it uses a verb of pleading, of begging. It's like, "You don't understand, I need you inside." And the eldest son accuses the father in 29. He said, "I'm a slave. I've never disobeyed. I've never even been given a goat for my friends." His description of self matches what the younger brother hoped to be. He said, "I'm a slave." The younger brother said, "Maybe I can be a slave." Standing outside the party implies that the eldest son doesn't want to join his father's party. He wants the same thing the younger son had, the right to throw his own and to be the person who has the guest list. He gets to dictate who gets to be part of the party. Because what he said was, "You didn't give me a goat for me and my friends," which also juxtaposes against what he calls his brother. "I have the good friends, he's the delinquent. I'm the one on the right, he's obviously wrong. How dare you sit with them?" And he even ends it with a stronger statement that says, "This son of yours," distancing himself from his younger brother. So he is still dead in the brother's eyes. "Consumed your livelihood with whores, and now you will kill, really, my fattened calf for him?" Highlighting the injustice, 31 and 32, just like before with the younger son, goes to the turn. The turn for the younger brother happens in the company of pigs. His rock bottom is a bit obvious. The older brother is a little bit more stubborn because he's right, he's moral, he's good. He needs the epiphany to come from his father's voice. And his father, hearing this rage, hearing this accusation of injustice, says, "My son," and actually uses a verb because from what I've been told of parents, children, at least from what my mom tells me, never quite get older than like 7. You can correct me if I'm wrong. So no matter how old they get, they're still your precious little darling, which is why when I met some of my mom's coworkers, they're like, "Oh, you're full grown." I was like, "Yes." They're like, "Well, the way she talked about my babies, that we were like more down here." It's like, no, I could have my own. But he used that kind of verb. He sees his older brother and goes, "Oh, my son, don't you know everything's yours?" But it was necessary. I needed to. There's no way to get around the necessity of restoring your younger brother to celebrate and be happy. And he even switches it because he says, "Your son," to distance. And he goes, "You don't know, it's your brother. Your brother's here. He was dead, but now he's alive. Your brother's here. Our family can be whole." But we're missing something from the first telling. The younger son had a return. He's restored into community. He's given a place of honor. The older brother is still out in the field. The symmetry is thrown off by not having the eldest son's story come to a conclusion, because that part had to be written by the scribes and Pharisees from verse 1 and 2. It's a Jewish storytelling practice not to relieve the tension of a story, because your lives have to write the next verse. How you live into, how you say, "I'm going to be part of community," how you accept somebody else finishes the parable of Jesus. Just like in the first two parables, he said, and they celebrated, they partied, and then all of heaven rejoiced. He said, And did you not know they found and they celebrated and the angels in the presence of God rejoiced? That's missing from this part because no one's joined the party yet. So now we're going to step into the moment of rifting, and because we've taken a little bit longer to set up the historical context, we're going to be a little quicker in this, and we're going to have a time of reflection. So if you're looking at the back of your notes, faith becomes complicated and real when we join the party. Now, I don't know how you're joining us today, as the older or younger brother. But either way, all is theory, all is hypothetical, all is just a debate, unless you come faith to faith with someone else at the party to celebrate. And I say faith to faith in the same way that the collection of people around Jesus' table were all deeply committed to their faith outcome of the Jewish story. And our biggest contests aren't with those who are completely different from us. They're usually those who look the same. They should be at the same table, but you need to agree with me. So if you feel unworthy, if your thoughts right now are drawn towards the statements of, if they saw me, if they knew what I believe, what I've done, if they only saw how I truly am, then they would never. I want to say, welcome to the party. It's thrown in your honor. We're so excited for you to be here. It's a gamble to trust us with your shame, with your pain, with your vulnerability. It's a gamble, but that is the only doorway into the party for you. You have to gamble on the community and that we will learn how to give space for you. If you're the boundary-setting, rule-honoring, community-gatekeeping, good and diligent Christian who has been around the church so long you don't know a day before it, and when you see it, you have these guttural reactions for who is allowed to be present. If we refuse to be at the party, we refuse our host, who is Christ. Jesus asked you to join his party, not for you to throw your own. In that, this is complicated, and it's difficult to give up that position of guard of the community, because as we go to point two, we celebrate presence over perfection. Perfection is easy, because usually what happens with perfection is I judge the rules and I bring it very close to whatever works for me. Present means I have to sit in your story, sit at your table, and you get to see not only my strengths, but my weakness. And then there, not only do you have to trust that I'll make space for you, but I have to do the ridiculous thing of trusting you'll create space for me. That this party is not a battle between brothers, but it's a restoration of a family. So we ask for your presence. And that presence is your act of faith. Because as long as we keep it abstract, we keep it theoretical, it never actually touches your life. And if it doesn't touch us your life, who cares? If you don't enter into a place of discomfort, if you're not sitting in a spot that you're ever thinking, why am I here? Honestly, who cares? You're not doing anything different than any other person would do. The tension at the table is because Jesus invited the younger and older brother. If your room only has a spot for one of them, for the repentant person that you say, I'm glad you see how ugly you are. For the excellent rule follower and like, look, our people are great. If you only have room for one of them, it's not Christ's table any longer. So I'm going to ask for point three. What keeps you from the party? Or actually, my apologies, who keeps you from the party? Because this is not a conversation about us against them, about liberals versus conservative, about the true understanding of the inspiration of the Bible or not. This is a collection of people gathering around an ancient story saying we can live out a future present faith in such a way to have tension held deeply, but in the presence of each other, which is exactly the party that God offered. So which person or group are you the gatekeeper for? That you say, oh yes, I would show up as long as. Now most of us don't say race anymore, but we would say gender, we would say sexuality, we might say other denominations, we might say other Christian traditions. And you said, we will show up, we will be present as a participant, not a gatekeeper, if you meet my criteria for who I say cannot be on the guest list. And that's the point that we need to wrestle with, because if we're going to be a Jesus-centered community sitting at the party we've been invited into, then the tension we must wrestle with, because most of us have been Christians for a while, is at what point do I look like the Pharisee, the older brother, who refuses to go to the party because you invited the one I wouldn't want there? So as we reflect on how we can enter into this party, I'd like to invite David up to close for me with words from the younger brother. As he shares his song, I want you to hear this as the voice of those being kept from the party, and hear it as a call back into community. If you identify with the younger brother and you say, if you only knew me, you would hate me, let this be your voice saying, I have need of community. I remember a time when things could have been whole. In this reflection, if you need a moment, like Kevin said, we believe in a present God, which also means we believe in prayer. So we'll have some people in the back in this time of reflection for you to go and either pray or be prayed for. Thank you.
Dear brother, it's been a rough day and I can't take another. I'm holding on, but I am going under. I'm too weak to swim. Dear brother, I've been dreaming about the days when we were younger. When I wake up in the morning, I wonder, will I be okay? I still miss you, it's been so long. I don't know how to get right on. I feel broken and I feel lost. Ain't been the same since you've been. I tried to grow up, but I still haven't recovered. I met this girl, we got married, oh, I love her. I thank you to prove. Dear brother, I still work the job I said would be the summer. I got some tattoos now, one day I'll be covered. Just like you, I still miss you, it's been so long. I don't know how to carry on. I feel broken and I feel lost. Ain't been the same since you've been gone. All I ever wanted was for you to be proud of the man that I turned out to be. All I really want is to have you by my side. All I really want is a chance to say goodbye. Dear brother, I've been dreaming about the days when we were younger. When I wake up in the morning, I wonder, will I be okay?
So as we go out this week, I want to send you with a blessing. May the peace of the Lord Christ go with you. Wherever he may send you, may he guide you through the wilderness, protect you through the storm. May he bring you home rejoicing at the wonders he has shown you. May he bring you home rejoicing once again to our doors. Go in peace.